Hi, I'm Phelan Johnson.
And I'm Leah Simone Bowen, and we look at history a bit differently. Have you ever wondered how hundreds of wild horses came to inhabit an island in the Atlantic Ocean?
Or what Lord of the Rings and a small town in Manitoba have in common? Or the burning question, did Canada invent the teen drama?
The Secret Life of Canada is a podcast about the country you know and the stories you don't. New episodes available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Matt Galloway, and this is The Current Podcast. It is the 2nd of April, and after a Canadian winter that was the warmest on record, by a huge margin, the tulip plants in Ottawa are much taller than they'd normally be. Gardens in Vancouver are a few weeks ahead of schedule, and on Toronto Island, gardener Lacey Hammond Harrington is noticing a difference as well.
We're right here against the house in my little garden. We call it the snake garden because there's a snake mosaic. And right now we have hyacinths up, which is quite early for them to be up. They're smelling delicious. My tulips are really well up. I just took off the chicken wire off of them, which I'm trying not to do anything in my garden right now because the bugs are meant to be, you know, hibernating. They need this time. And yet my tulip greens are so high up that they were being strangled by my chicken wire. But yeah, I mean, it's just so much green bursting through, and it, you know, sometimes it's under snow. It should be snowy at this time of, like, what is that? Sorry.
What is that?
Monk's hood. It's like fully, like full greens down there already. It's unbelievable. I haven't even thought to cut off the dead stalks from last year because I would never do it at this time of year.
Hear those red-winged blackbirds in the background? That's the sound of spring. With so much changing in our gardens, some of the usual rules may not apply, including what types of plants would do best in a region based on the climate. For more on how our gardens are changing, how we can adapt, I'm joined by two people in different parts of this country. Linda Gilkison is an entomologist, a gardening author, and a consultant who tends to her own garden on Salt Spring Island in British Columbia. And Paul Zammit is a professor of horticulture at Niagara College, also the regular gardening expert on CBC Radio's Ontario Today. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Paul, let's start with you. You are in the Toronto area. What has spring looked like for you thus far?
Well, it looks like we didn't have winter at all, Matt. I mean, things are just going. I've got plants that are already flowering, corydalis, as an example, that I do not know ever on record have to have flowered this early. So I've also even emptied my compost already, Matt. Usually it's still fairly quite cold and parts of it are frozen and kind of scares me a little bit, I'll be quite honest.
Kind of scares you a little bit?
It does, because I'm very keen to get out into the garden and do all that I can. And I'm excited kind of about having a longer season. But I also know the importance of the snow and having that snow. And when we didn't have that snow, how dry things are, and what does that mean for the months ahead in terms of moisture content, restoring our waterways, our rivers, etc. So that makes me a bit nervous.
All right, I'm going to come back to that in a moment. Linda, what about for you out on Salt Spring? What are you seeing in terms of changes in how the weather and this changing climate is affecting your garden?
Well, yes, we've had a warmer than usual winter as well. Now, we're used to, obviously, much earlier blooming of our spring flowers, so we're a few weeks ahead for sure. But what we're really reeling from out here is the damage that was done by an extreme cold snap in January. And we're only just still discovering what plants are going to make it and what aren't. Surely it's been on the news quite a bit about the, you know, complete wipeout of the wine grape crop in the Okanagan, loss of crops. So a tremendous amount of damage happened to plants. It was very, very cold. It was unusually cold for an Arctic outbreak for us. But also it happened during this very warm winter when plants probably weren't completely hardened off or may have even started to resume growth again.
You saw damage in your own garden?
Oh, yes. Yes, there's been a lot of damage. There's damage to plants I've never seen damaged here. English laurel, of course, our arbutus trees, every time we get a bad cold, we lose some leaves. Some of it's just leaf damage, some rhododendrons that I haven't seen leaf damage before. But I was at a friend's garden yesterday and we were trying to see if the Rose of Sharon was alive. It doesn't look like it has. The Escalonia is gone. People lost bay trees and, you know, things like that that are probably things you wouldn't grow in Eastern Canada at all. But we're used to, I think what we're used to is not knowing how close to the margin some of our plant material is to being frozen out. And we lost a lot of that. And then a lot of people in BC, you know, people push the envelope and we try and grow citrus trees and protect them with a Christmas lights or something. And a lot of citrus trees froze this winter because there wasn't enough protection. So
I don't know the Christmas lights too much to protect the trees, but it looks nice.
Well, no, it actually is adequate here with a cover on them, you know, really? Plastic or something, and Christmas lights just flipping on when it's because if the temperatures only go to -5, that's just fine. That tree is fine. Yeah. I grew lemons for years without any problems, but -12 or -15, which is more of what we got on the coast, which for us is extremely cold, that it overrode any protection people did. But more importantly is there's a lot of landscape material that was damaged. In this climate, we can grow quite a few of the hardy winter vegetables and have them in our gardens all winter, or with minimal protection, maybe a tarp. And a lot of that froze out this year. The root crops were fine, but the broccoli and things like that, a lot of that was damaged.
There's some real mixed emotions around this, because I think a lot of people grind through a winter and they think, I can't believe that it's spring. And I was saying, you know, earlier, it's the most wonderful time of the year. Have a listen once again to Lacey Hammond-Harrington on Toronto Island. She was talking about how those swings in temperature and an earlier spring than perhaps people are expecting can really kind of bring up some of those conflicting emotions.
I was just talking with a neighbor about the cold weather last week and how it felt good to have that cold weather because it felt normal. And yet it's so hard not to also feel a little joyful when it's March and it's sunny and we can be outside in our sweaters and start gardening. And yeah, I definitely grapple with it. It's hard. I feel guilty when I feel joy for the sun, I guess.
Paul Zammit, do you feel guilty when the daffodils are up a few weeks earlier than normal?
No, just a bit concerned. To me, the gardening season is never long enough, Matt. The days in the garden are never long enough. So the more time I can get to be out there. So like I said, I'm excited to be able to spread my compost. But what gets me concerned is how early things are and how off skew and the potential impact of that. With things flowering before, are they going to get pollinated? Are the insects going to emerge that need to pollinate them? And these are all regulated by temperatures, and fluctuations can alter that. And they're very closely related to one another. So again, that is a concern because of just how early it is.
When there's a lack of a long, hard freeze, what does that do? I mean, not just to the ground and what's beneath the ground, but for example, we'll talk more about bugs in a moment, but to insects, what does that mean in terms of that lack of a hard freeze and what that might do to our plants, Paul?
Well, from the standpoint of them going into a dormancy, so for example, Matt, I overwinter a lot of plants. I have a lot of containers and I typically stick them into my garage when things freeze solid for about good 10 days. I didn't even do that this year and they're already beginning to grow. So if they're beginning to grow, what does that mean for any insects, even potentially pests? Are they just going to get up even earlier, begin to wake up and become more active? So are we going to have a longer infestation period in the garden of these pests? How is that going to affect our native insects? And are they going to be in sync with the plant material that they need to pollinate? So there's a lot of factors that relate. And yes, I enjoy being out there as early as possible. I think that is great. But again, that concern of how off things may be and the potential impacts of that, really.
Linda, you could imagine there are people thinking, you know what, it's warmer. Maybe I can grow something that I was never able to grow before. Are they right?
Well, I call this the banana hopers out here. believe it or not, there actually are there were some banana plants on Salt Spring outdoors. But if you're just growing for the summertime, we're finding people are having very good success growing sweet potatoes or yams, things like that, that really do need a lot of heat. We're having to alter how we grow a number of crops because we definitely have much warmer summers or warmer periods in the summer. So yes, it can change that we can grow warm season things. But if we're talking about perennial plants, we have not lost this extreme cold risk that happens with polar outbreaks. And in fact, someone I know that's a retired DFO scientist, looked at the minimum temperatures that are happening in the wintertime at Victoria and Qualicum Beach, which is on Vancouver Island, and found that, yes, the winters on average are warmer, but the cold spike that we're getting has been decreasing. So if perennial material has to be hardier and able to withstand more, whereas our summer garden material, yes, sure, we're pushing the envelope, we're growing more longer crops of tomatoes and, you know, things like sweet potatoes.
Tell me about this cauliflower that you're excited about.
Oh, the winter cauliflower?
Yeah.
Well, actually, mine made it through the winter. I was surprised. This is, in this climate, we can grow the biennial broccoli and cauliflowers. We start them the previous summer. They sit out the winter as small plants, and then they're producing now. I just picked a lovely cauliflower this week.
Very nice.
But we're now having to increase our protection quite a lot. 30 years ago, I didn't rush out throwing tarps over things and, you know, to get my chard through the winter and things like that. Now I do. And I think gardeners in this area are having to learn some gardening skills that people have in colder climates and hotter climates. Mm. We have to shade things in the summer.
We were talking yesterday on the program about drought and water concerns. And this is on the West Coast. We were talking about Mexico City, but also in Alberta as well. In Edmonton, longtime gardener Linda Relling is planning to do things differently this year just because of how dry it's been. Have a listen.
It was very dry. I'm sure everybody's heard about the fires we had all over the province, tinder dry. And this year, because we were watering so much, I am going to put in my pots succulents, things that require very, very little water and can take heat. And I'm going to investigate native plants in my pots instead of annuals that you're really babysitting through the summer and watering.
Paul Zammit, what do we do about this? People across the country who are worried about things like drought and also water restrictions, what's your advice for them?
Well, Matt, I'm really glad to hear people are talking about water. I tell this to my students at the college all the time, respecting it as a resource, whether we've got a lot or a little, to respect it and how we're using it. So one thing I like to remind everyone is we have the opportunity to capture water when it comes. So making sure if you can, install rain barrels to catch anything that's coming down. Also, just as was previously being said, what we're planting. My garden is very sandy, Matt, so I don't want to put plants that I need to constantly pamper and give a lot of water. So I'm looking for plants that are much more drought tolerant. And there is a lean and a push to rediscovering the amazing world of our native plants that are much more resilient, that once established are much more drought tolerant. I also encourage people to do what they can to conserve moisture, not only capture it, but conserve it. So one thing I tend to do is my mantra is feed the garden from the garden. So I tend to use a lot of leaves to capture organic matter to get those to break down. And that helps water holding capacity within the soil. So there are many things that we can do. I just ask everyone, every time you go to turn on the tap, think about why you're doing so. And can we, you know, reduce the amount of times that we're doing so? And can we get that water from another source?
This is kind of like the dream time for gardeners. I walk past a garden center every day and I can see them starting to bring things in, that there are shipments of things arriving and eventually the doors will open and I will be able to go and start to plot out what I'm going to put into the garden. Paul, what's the one thing that you think gardeners could do this spring to make sure, in light of everything that we've been talking about, that they have a good season?
To really make sure they know their garden, Matt, to watch the light conditions, to know their soil type, and rather than get tempted, and listen, I'm guilty of this too. I've been going through growers and visiting garden centers already, just to avoid that temptation of thinking of beauty versus function. Mm. So finding that plant that matches that location to our soil type, our water conditions, and also think about, Matt, how we can invite guests into the garden. And I'm not talking other individuals, and all due respect to people, but pollinators, insects, birds, etc. And again, that brings us back to using more and more native plants that can support, because the power of our gardens to do that is really pretty incredible. So thinking carefully when we're choosing, looking at function versus aesthetics.
Linda, do you have a word of advice for the gardener, good or the black thumb, who might be worried that everything that we've talked about is going to lead to a terrible season ahead?
No, it's not. There's a tremendous amount of plant material that will do just fine. Mostly it's the gardener's brain, I think, that needs to change a bit. We just have to remember that extreme weather of any kind can happen anytime. Be ready for it. If people have been gardening in an area for a while, remember your past practices may not serve you well in the present. We need to be, you know, keep learning, stay adapting, be really flexible. Maybe don't rely on gardening books from 50 years ago, you know. And I just want to put a plug in too, on top of what Paul is saying, is, you know, help sequester carbon, grow more plants, grow woody shrubs and trees that are deep rooted, the native plant material that doesn't require any irrigation, and, you know, sort of help mitigate climate change by growing more plants. So I think that's the very hopeful message for a lot of gardeners.
I mean, one of the reasons why we are out of time, but I have to ask you this. One of the reasons why people end up in the garden is because it's a break from kind of the worries of the real world in some ways. Do you worry that some of those things are starting to intrude a little bit into the gardening space, Linda? Or is that just part of how we adapt to those plants that are around us?
It does. Yes, there is a sadness when I see that there's far fewer insects than there were when I was growing up. The dawn chorus of the birds is much diminished now. Yeah. So there's many, obviously, less birds. So yes, there is a sadness, but the garden still is a fantastic place to be, and things are growing and they're beautiful and they smell and taste good. And, you know, there is an undercurrent of sadness and regret, I have to say, for me, but a tremendous amount of enjoyment.
And in the face of that, Paul, you still are able to find joy in the garden and hope in the garden?
Actually, it's what keeps me going, Matt. With all the sadness that's out there, at least in the garden, I feel I can do my part, knowing that what I'm doing in the garden extends beyond the boundaries by attracting and supporting pollinators, bringing in birds, doing what I can. So it really, it's always been a source of therapy, but I will say it now is heightened because it does give me hope, knowing that I can do something in my space that is going to go far beyond the boundaries and hopefully help out a little bit.
I can't wait to get my hands in the dirt. Good to talk to you both. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matt.
Linda Gilkison is a gardening author and consultant on Salt Spring Island in British Columbia. Paul Zammit, professor of horticulture at Niagara College, also the regular gardening expert on CBC Radio in Ontario.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're making decisions on what to plant and when to plant it, gardeners will often turn to something called the zone hardiness map. Right now, for example, Vancouver is in zone 8, Winnipeg is in zone 3, and you can choose your plants accordingly. With the climate changing, though, the U.S. map just got an update last year, and there is a new one in the works in Canada as well. Dan McKenney is a senior scientist with Natural Resources Canada. Dan, good morning to you.
Morning, Matt.
You're in Sault Ste. Marie in northern Ontario. What does your garden look like, and what does gardening look like this spring?
Well, the snow is all gone here, too. It's been an unusual winter in Sault Ste. Marie, and I think across much of the north. So the geese are already back, and I'm not sure. I don't think we're quite as far ahead as Paul was, but things are starting to pop up a little bit.
But it's happening for sure. Just explain what this zone hardiness map means. Practically, what does that mean for gardeners?
Well, basically, the zones identify, as you noted, what can grow where. And this was created back in the 1960s by some scientists in Agriculture Canada, where they planted test sites across 108 locations right across the country. They planted 174 different species of plants, and they grew them and looked at their hardiness, how well they survived. And then they correlated that statistically with a bunch of different climate variables. And ultimately, what they came up with was a statistical model that gave us the hardiness zones. It gave us an index that indicates what can grow in different climates right across the country.
And so why do we need to update that now?
Well, clearly, as everybody feels, climate is changing. What we've been doing is updating them every 10 years or so, because the World Meteorological Organization calls these 30-year averages climate normals. So they basically change a little bit over a 10-year period. And so we just thought we should update this.
How do you go about doing that? I mean, do you repeat that process where you plant things all across the country and then watch them and see what lives and what dies?
I wish we did. I think it'd be a great thing. We don't do that. Obviously, that would be very expensive. But what we've been doing is just taking the climate station data that Environment Climate Change Canada, collects, and we generate basically mathematical models that describe the climate right across the country. So not away from weather stations even. So that's how we're able to replicate this approach.
And is this how the Americans do it? I mentioned that the Americans are changing their map as well. Is this how they do it in the United States?
The United States has a different approach. They use just extreme minimum temperature, where we have seven different climate variables. The scientists back in the 1960s found that variables like minimum temperature is the coldest month, maximum temperature is the hottest month, the frost-free period, snow cover. Rain in January was actually another important variable. Whereas in the American system, they're really just using one extreme minimum temperature. In Canada, clearly, snow cover is important. They don't have as much snow, although they do in parts of the U.S. But as Paul noted, there was no snow cover even in parts of the country like Niagara and Bowen Sound, where we get lots of snow usually, but it disappeared this year.
And so I know the new map isn't out yet, but give us a heads up. I mean, what can you say about the general trends and how things are changing based on how the climate in this country is changing?
Yeah, I guess I would like to make a couple of points. One is that the climate, these models are basically based on 30-year averages, and the overlap with the last period is actually 20 years. So I don't think the change is going to be a lot. It might change a little bit in some spots. I think one part of the country where it's difficult is Alberta, where they get Chinooks and that sort of thing, which actually makes it difficult for those folks to try things to get their gardens growing because of these massive changes in weather that can happen. But another important point is that these are averages, and every year we get different weather that can affect plants, which is basically what your previous guests have been talking about. So it's, I don't think you're going to see a lot of change, but there could be some in some parts of the country.
Some parts of the country, as I understand it, the West is going to see more change than the East. Is that right?
Yeah, that's really what's been happening with the work that we've done previously. And I think that sort of coincides with what's known about climate change. But again, remember, this isn't just about temperature. It's about snowfall. It's about precipitation, all those sorts of things. So those changes vary across the country depending on where you are. So that makes it a little bit complicated to predict.
How well do you think that the maps take into account the impact of extreme heat on our gardens? We have seen, I mean, whether it's heat domes out west or just unseasonably scorching temperatures, that can have a real impact, not just on issues of drought, but also on the plants themselves and their ability to survive. Do the maps take that into effect?
No, absolutely. Heat's an important thing, and heat in conjunction with precipitation, because that causes dryness and drought and that sort of thing. The models in Canada use maximum temperature the hottest month, but it's not extreme heat, which is an important thing. And the U.S. sites, they do use heat maps, and it's something that we're thinking about incorporating. Things like the fire index that is used to look at fire risk across the country, that makes use of daily weather and heat conditions and that sort of thing. So it's a little different problem, but definitely heat extremes are something that we want to look at and try to develop models for.
I'll let you go, but just finally, what do you think we can learn about the changing climate from our interactions with plants in the garden? I was saying earlier that in many ways people look at gardening perhaps as an escape from the real world, but you're there and you see the plants and you see the ground and the conditions that they're growing and changing. What can we learn from that?
Well, I think we are learning to be adaptable. That's important. I also think we need to remain optimistic about climate change and work towards improving it. Planting trees, planting plants, all of those sorts of things can help sequester carbon and make the country more resilient to a changing climate.
Dan, good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matt.
Dan McKenney is a senior scientist with Natural Resources Canada. He was in Sault Ste. Marie. Are you starting to think about the garden? Are you starting to think differently about the garden? Are you noticing that what you're planting perhaps is changing because of a changing climate? You can let us know. People love to talk about the weather, how the weather used to be, but also what they're planting in light of that weather and the climate. You can email us, thecurrent@cbc.ca.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.